You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to Tea Break Time Travel, where every month we look at a different archaeological object and take you on a journey into their past. Hello and welcome to episode 48 of Tea Break Archaeology. I'm Mathilde Siebrecht and today I'm savouring actually just a nice little fruity tea. It's called Kaminfeuer, which basically translates to like fireplace in German, and it's so delicious. It's got like fruit and cinnamon and all kinds of nice things. Trying to avoid caffeine because I'm recording this late in the evening. And today I am having a little bit of a deep dive into a new topic for me, which is the archaeology of clothing. Now, full disclosure, I am not a textile archaeologist. Luckily, the next two episodes after this will be featuring special guest Nia Lau, who is a textile archaeologist. So don't worry, there will be more discussed about this particular field of archaeology, but I wanted to look at it from a material culture perspective, looking a little bit more at the kind of physical remains of what we have and how we can interpret clothing in the past from a material culture standpoint, from an artifact-based standpoint. So yeah, that's what we're going to be doing today. Before we get into it, I do, first of all, just want to say thank you very much for listening in to this podcast. I'm so grateful that lots of people seem to be downloading this podcast every month and listening into the episodes. I do sometimes get feedback, but I don't really get that much, actually. So what would be really great is if you're listening to this, to just let me know what you think. Let me know what you think about the new format that's been going on for the last couple of months. I'm sort of wondering whether it works, whether, I don't know, to sort of change things up a little bit, whether to just kind of keep going and focusing on various different aspects of it. So just let me know what you think of the format. Also, let me know what kind of materials or objects or crafts you would like to see featured on the podcast. I'm always very happy to get inspiration from different people. If you are researching particular objects, if you have a particular favorite object and you're an archaeologist and you want to come on and chat about it, yeah, just get in touch. If you want to learn more about a particular topic, feel free to suggest it and I'll do a deep dive and we can learn together about new topics. So yeah, please do get in touch. Sometimes it's a bit difficult as a podcaster to know how people are receiving the podcast. It's all very well to sort of read reviews and things, but direct feedback is always very nice. So if you check out the show notes, you will find my email address. So feel free to drop me an email. You can also join the Archaeology Podcast Network Discord server, and I have a dedicated channel on there for the podcast so people can come there and chat. It's open for everyone. You don't have to be a member to join. You can also find my Instagram, which is also linked in the show notes. I don't get notified on the different podcasting platforms. So if you're leaving comments directly on whatever podcasting platform you're listening to, it's very unlikely that I will see it. Also, for example, YouTube, because I know that the Archaeology Podcast Network posts these up on YouTube as well, but I don't get those notifications. So if you want to provide feedback, if you want to get in touch, the best way to do it is either email or my Instagram or on the APN Discord server. And also on that note, I do want to give a little bit of a shout out to the Archaeology Podcast Network. I also am involved with them as well, but obviously as a host of a podcast on the Archaeology Podcast Network, I couldn't do this without the team that works behind it, editing and producing. So I'm not paid to do this, but I also don't have to pay anything. It's all completely free to listen to as well. And that is all thanks to the APM members who, by subscribing to the network, are able to support the network, to keep it going, to keep it free, to keep it open access, to keep it available to podcasters to be able to share their insights and expertise with you, as I hopefully am doing as well. So if this is something that you think you also want to support, I would really strongly recommend checking out the website and seeing how you perhaps could become a member and help to support the Archaeology Podcast Network. Because yeah, by helping the network, you are helping communicators such as myself in being able to continue doing what we're doing and being able to offer it for free to the majority of people who perhaps can't afford it. So that's my little promotional moment there, my little call to action. And now we can dive a little bit into the archaeology of clothing. So first of all, I guess, what actually is clothing? There's been all kinds of official definitions. And of course, as with anything, yes, you can have some sort of terminology that is used that the majority of people think, well, of course, it's this. What do you mean? What is clothing? It's obviously this. But when you start to research things, when you start to have to compare things, when you have to start defining things, it can get very complicated very quickly. And so there's lots of discussions between archaeologists and about how we define things, what kind of terminology we use, what kind of categories we use, just to make sure that it is as standardized as possible and as comparable as possible. Because, of course, that's good science, right? That's good research practice, is to make things replicable, to make things easily comparable. So yes, this is something that might seem like a straightforward question, but is actually surprisingly complicated. There's been a couple of different researchers talking about this. For example, one suggestion was to differentiate between cloth and clothing, because clothing is a finished garment. It's something that you wear as a covering with intentionality. So like a blanket, right? That's not an item of clothing. If, however, you sew up a blanket and cut it up and put some armholes in there and do all of that kind of thing, then that is clothing, an item of clothing. So it's sort of more complicated than it seems at first glance, actually. So we're talking today about the archaeology of clothing. So sort of sewn garments with an intention to actually cover the body for protection against the elements, but also more often for a kind of demonstration of sociability and identity. And this is something that is brought up a lot in the study of clothing, especially ancient clothing, because a lot of people say, oh yes, well, we only started using clothing to protect ourselves from the elements, because at the time when clothing first starts to emerge, we think that's when there was a very much colder climate in many parts of the world at that time, in the sort of early upper Paleolithic. And that's why we started using clothing. It was to protect ourselves, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of other people say, well, yes, maybe that was one aspect, but it is important not to forget that actually using clothing as a way to ornament yourself is also a really important part of sort of human evolution and social development. And we start to see a lot of things like ornamentation, so different beads and evidence of tattooing and all these kinds of things are also starting to emerge around the same time we start to see evidence of clothing. So there is also the idea that, okay, maybe indeed having that physical protection against the elements was a part of why we started using clothing in the past. But actually, it could as likely or as strong a reason might be as a way of decorating ourselves. And maybe it was that, you know, it was a way of decorating yourself. And then you found out that actually, this makes me a bit warmer. Maybe I'll keep wearing this. And there's also something, a sort of another definition of simple clothing versus complex clothing. So complex clothing is more kind of tailored garments, etc. So there's a lot of different things to sort of consider when we're looking at the origins of clothing and why people might have started using it and why people then continued to use it. Because I think nowadays in sort of modern society, there's a lot of taboos a lot of the time around what kind of clothing can be worn, what's appropriate. You know, walking around naked isn't really seen as socially acceptable in most places these days. But that's sort of a social limitation, because I feel like most of the time, especially depending on what kind of country you live in terms of environment, it would actually be lovely to be able to walk around without clothes on if you're not sweating all the time or all of that kind of thing. So it now is really a big part. The social part is sort of one of the biggest parts, one could argue, especially in certain parts of the world. Anyway, so that is kind of a little bit of a discussion about the origins of clothing. It's a very complex issue and it's very hard to determine why people started wearing clothes. And there's a lot of debate around those different reasons, whether it was purely practical, sort of biological need for warmth, or whether it was kind of a cultural development and a social development in that way. So what are the oldest remains that we have, the oldest evidence that we have for clothing? Well, the oldest actual textile remains that are definitely a garment, a finished garment, it's known as the Tarkan dress, and it's called Tarkan because that is the name of the cemetery that it comes from. It's made of linen, so it's a woven fabric. It comes from ancient Egypt, from the site of Tarkan in Egypt. So it dates to ancient Egypt, to the first dynasty, or potentially even pre-first dynasty, around 5,000 years ago. And I love the story behind this. So the garment was actually discovered amongst a pile of kind of linen and cloth pieces. This was back in 1977. It was kind of discovered. The original excavation happened in 1913. And it was only when people were going through all of the excavated materials in 1977 that they found a kind of bundled pile of all these different cloth fragments that have been excavated. And amongst that, they found this beautifully constructed, tailored garment, which is now considered to be the oldest, like, actual textile remains, clothing remains in the world, which is amazing. So that just also a little archaeology of archaeology there. It's always, that's also why I really love working with kind of legacy collections, because there are all these old collections that have been sitting in the archives for who knows how long. And then you can find all kinds of amazing gems and new information just by looking through them. What I really like is a quote from one of the researchers, which is that the garment had clearly been worn in life because it was found inside out, as it very well might be after having been pulled over the head, with distinct signs of creasing at the elbows and under the armpits. So what I love is the idea that maybe someone was like, no, you can't wear that shirt. And the guy was like, oh, okay. So he quickly stripped it off, shoved it on top of a pile of other cloths that then just kind of stayed there and was just left there, was then excavated out 5,000 years later. And then 60 years after that excavation was then found in that pile of clothes. So a really amazing biography. But yeah, so that's the oldest sort of textile remains that we have. The oldest existing fibers that could be used for textile production have been found much, much later. So they've been dated to around 34,000 years ago. There were some wild flax fibers, which were found in, and I'm going to mispronounce this, Zuzuana cave in the Republic of Georgia. So they date to 34,000 years ago. So significantly older than the linen tarka dress, which is 5,000 years old, remember? And these fibers, they're made from wild flax, as I said, and they're clearly intended for use in some form because they were dyed in sort of black and gray and turquoise and even pink using other local plant materials. So this really suggests that they were being intentionally created for use in some sort of decorative form. Also suggests a very advanced kind of cognitive skills, which is also really exciting for this particular time period. So we don't have an actual sort of cloth or garment from this time, clothing, but we do have the fibers that then could have been used for some sort of clothing. It's just that didn't preserve. And this is something true. I should have mentioned this at the beginning. This is something that happens a lot because textiles are organic materials. So organic materials such as textiles, wood, leather, bone, those materials do not survive very well in the archaeological record because they disintegrate a lot quicker in the ground. So this is also why the majority of finds that archaeologists have are stone or ceramic most of the time, or other inorganic materials such as stone or ceramic, because they survive longer in the ground. They won't really disintegrate. They just kind of preserve. However, in order for organic remains to be preserved, you have to have really excellent preservation conditions. And this can vary. So for example, there's been a lot of clothing and textile remains discovered from bog bodies, which are bodies that are preserved within bogs. So they're sort of anaerobic conditions. They're in water, they're in cool, watery locations. So they're very well preserved. It almost acts like a kind of natural wet fridge in a way. And speaking of fridge, of course, very cold environments will also preserve organic material very well. So that's why I did my PhD research project on bone and antler and ivory materials from the Arctic, because they preserve beautifully in the permafrost. You can also have organic remains preserved in very dry and arid environments. So for example, there's been a lot of places like in Egypt and other places in the kind of Arabian Gulf as well, where you have very nicely preserved organic remains just because of the environment. And this is very important to remember, because that means that just because you're not finding organic remains in particular parts of the world doesn't mean that they didn't exist. It just means that there's a preservation bias. It means that there's limits to how much ancient materials can preserve in the ground. So therefore, we just won't find them if they don't preserve, of course. So that's also important to note when you're seeing like where all these different finds are coming, and when people are saying, oh yes, well, this must have originated here because that's the oldest evidence we have for it. Not necessarily. It might be that it was somewhere else. It's just that it wasn't the right preservation conditions for it to survive until the modern day for archaeologists to discover it. So those are the kind of oldest textile remains. It is, of course, very likely that the earliest clothes were made from kind of skins and leather, because that is, it is suggested, a sort of easier technological process to master than weaving and kind of creating. Because if you think about it, when you're weaving clothes and using things like linen, then you have to first create the actual cloth, you know, the textile, in order to then make the garment. Whereas if you're using something like leather, it's already there. You have to do a lot of scraping and you have to do a lot of preparation, but it's a sort of slightly more straightforward process requires slightly less technological complexity in that way. So it's sort of generally accepted that the earliest clothes were likely made from skins and leather, but again, organic material. So again, not very well preserved. So the earliest example of sewn hide that we have, actually, very excitingly, the article for this was published on February 4th of this year. So it's hot off the press, only been out for a month as I record this. And it comes from the Cougar Mountain Cave in Oregon in the USA that dates to between around 12,900 and 11,700 years ago. So that's really incredible that we have a piece of sewn hide from this long ago. The hide itself is from North American elk, and the cord that is sewn along the edge of one edge of the hide is a mixture of plant fibers and animal hairs. And I've put the links to various different things that I mentioned in this episode in the show notes, so please do go and check them out. I've put the article about this discovery in the show notes as well. It's open access, so you can read it freely. And the pictures, oh my goodness, it's amazing. The beautiful objects that are coming out of here. For example, a lot of beautifully made eyed bone needles. So that really suggests that sewing was a big part of this site, and kind of hide working and leather working and sewing of that in that way was a really big part of life at this particular site. So a very exciting find. And yeah, it pushes back. So we know that fibers were available and being created around 34,000 years ago, sort of at least, you know, maybe possibly even older. And what's really fascinating about this new discovery of the oldest example of sewn hide, as I say, there were these really beautifully created eyed bone needles and made in such a way that they were clearly already very specialized in this particular technology and in this particular process. So that means that they had already been sewing for a long time, probably before this time as well. How long? We don't know, but it's always very interesting, and we'll have to see whether we find any other examples of ancient clothing. So let's take a very quick break to top up our tea, but don't worry, we'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. I hope that the teacup is fuller and the biscuit jar is emptier. So we were talking about the oldest remains of actual clothing, but how else can we then look? If clothing doesn't preserve well in the archaeological record, right, how can we actually see what kinds of things people were wearing in the past? So one way of doing that is, of course, indirectly through looking at the tools. Now, the problem is quite a lot of the tools used are also made from organic material. So, for example, needles, right, are the most common tool that you would associate with the art of kind of clothing production in a way. But the majority of needles are also made from organic materials, mostly bone. That seems to be the most common material used for needles in the past that we've discovered so far. Interestingly enough, there has actually been a stone needles discovered, and oh, they are beautiful. I've put a link to that in the show notes as well, dated to around 9,000 years ago, discovered in Western Tibet near the shore of Lake Tchada. I apologize again for my mispronunciation. And they're, yeah, it's amazing. They were discovered back in 2020, and they're these tiny stone artifacts. They're about sort of a couple of centimeters long, a pointed tip at one end and an eye-like opening at the other. And honestly, if you look at the picture, yeah, they're needles. They look like needles. So that's really fascinating, these little stone needles. So that's really intriguing. And then obviously at some point in later prehistory, you do start to see the emergence of metal needles like copper, etc., coming into action. But bone needles are the ones that are most often used, especially in kind of the earliest prehistory. And so that's most likely what the earliest tools were. Interestingly enough, one of the suggestions is that actually the first sewing that was taking place wasn't taking place with needles. It was only taking place with awls. And awls, A-W-L, are sort of basically pointed tools that are used to make holes in hides or leather, processed leather and processed hides, in order for a thread to be able to pass through it. So especially when you're working, even nowadays, with like really thick leather, you'll quite often use an awl initially to create the hole for then the needle to pass through. But the idea was that actually initially they would use an awl, they would poke that into the hide to create the hole, and then they would just with their fingers just poke the cord through the hole, and that would be the sewing. So the awl was to make the hole, and then you would kind of thread the hole with that, with the cord. And interestingly enough, the oldest awls, also made from bone, come from Blombos Cave in South Africa, and they date to around 73,000 to 70,000 years ago. And there's been a very extensive use wear analysis study conducted, which kind of support their interpretation as an awl that would have been used for this kind of process. So that's very exciting. And so that, yeah, those are 73,000 to 70,000 years ago. The oldest needle that we have dates to 50,000 years ago. And this is a bone needle. So that comes from Denisova Cave in the Altai Mountains. People might recognize the name Denisova. I never know how you pronounce it. It's one of the most important archaeological sites, I would argue. It was occupied by modern humans, but also Neanderthals and Denisovans, who were another ancient hominin species. And it had sort of very regular occupation by these three species for around kind of 250,000 years. And it's also a very important site because it has a particular finger bone that was discovered there, which led to the and some further analysis and the kind of interpretation and discussion that of interbreeding between different species. So interbreeding between Denisovans, and Neanderthals. So a very important site for multiple reasons. The reason that it's so exciting for us talking about right now is that this is where the oldest bone needle has been discovered. So again, as I mentioned in the previous segment as well, the important thing with looking at these specialized tools like awls and like bone needles is that they wouldn't have just magically been made, you know, overnight. It's not that overnight people suddenly went, oh yes, this is a great tool. This will be wonderful for making clothing. Let's do that now. This must have been a process that developed over time. It takes a while to develop complex technologies such as this. And so, like I said, the suggestion was that initially awls would have been used. Maybe at some point people started to get frustrated with having to thread the cord directly through the holes. So they started to make the awls thinner and started to put holes in the end of them. And then this eventually led, which they could then thread the cord through. And then this eventually led to the awls kind of becoming needles in that way. So yeah, I find awls and needles very fascinating. I had an analysis of quite a few different artifacts that have been catalogued as awls in the kind of archaeological excavation reports. But when I conducted use wear on them, I did not see any evidence of this use, of them being used as awls. You can see from the microwear traces what they were used for and how they were used. And there was no microwear traces that would have suggested the action of kind of piercing through hides. So I found that really fascinating. And so I would be really interested in looking more at these kind of objects for the particular culture that I was looking at, the Paleo-Inuit cultures of the Canadian Arctic. But anyway, point being, the ones that were found at Blombos Cave, dating to around 70,000 years ago, were used for that. They do have microwear traces that support this interpretation. So that's kind of needles. So, but again, needles and awls, those are A, by the time they get to a point where they are recognizable as needles and awls, they probably had already existed in some cruder form for who knows how long before then. So this isn't the start of sewing. This is already a well-developed practice that people are already very experienced in and has been passed down for generations. So who knows how long it had been going on for before then. And the reason we don't know how long it's going on before then is because B, they are organic materials. They're bone. So they also are, yeah, victims of preservation bias. So we don't know whether there would have been others around, and we just can't find them in the archaeological record. So instead, we have to look at stone tools. And as I mentioned, there have been some stone needles discovered in Tibet. But one of the other tools that you can look at to sort of get an idea of whether clothing might have been being produced are scrapers. Now, scrapers are used for hide preparation. And of course, it's important to note that just because a hide is being prepared and scraped in this way doesn't necessarily mean it's then going to be used for clothing. So also, for example, the oldest evidence of sewn hide that we mentioned before, they don't actually know if that was a piece of clothing. They assume it was just because of the other artifacts that were found on site. But yeah, it's always difficult to say, unless it's something like the Tarkan dress, which is very clearly an item of clothing. If you've just got fragments of things, it's also hard to say what exactly the end garment was supposed to be, or the complete object is supposed to look like. But one thing that you can suggest is that if people are starting to scrape hides, this means that you're wanting to soften the hide. So basically, one of the ways that you can prepare a hide without tanning it, so tanning it will use some kind of fat or protein to basically break down a lot of the material of the hide so that it becomes sort of soft and more pliable. And that's what's commonly done today, and what was commonly done in sort of later prehistory and the medieval period. However, in very early prehistory and in quite a lot of other parts of the world today, especially, for example, in Paleo-Inuit communities and even historic Inuit communities as well, you had a non-tan method. So you basically have your hide, you have a stone tool, which you use to scrape off the inside, all of the meat and fat and everything from the inside of the hide. You then dry it. And then you scrape it again, and then you dry it, and you scrape it again, you dry it, you scrape it again. And in between, you're also like doing folding, and you're sort of stamping on it, and you're basically trying to soften it as much as possible naturally. This does mean that if you don't wear a piece of hide or a piece of leather that has been worked in this way, it will kind of naturally stiffen again. Whereas if it's tanned, it will usually not stiffen as much, or it will take longer to anyway. So that's quite interesting, is that, you know, it's sort of assumed that these objects were also untanned leather clothing, for example, would have automatically softened as you wear it, because you're constantly working it and you're constantly sort of softening it through the art of wearing it. Think of like a pair of shoes that you have to wear in, right? So it's that kind of concept. So it's sort of suggested that, okay, if you start to see evidence of scrapers, these stone scrapers, these very specific kind of stone tools, then that probably means that they're wanting to soften the hides. One of the main reasons why you might want to soften hides is because you're wanting to form it into particular shapes. You're wanting to maybe pierce it with something like an awl. You're wanting to maybe sew it together. You're wanting to maybe create clothes. So that's the kind of logic that goes in that way. So the oldest stone hide scrapers that have been kind of definitely categorized as scrapers actually date to 800,000 years ago. So a very long time ago. Again, this doesn't necessarily prove that there was clothing at this time. It's just very strongly suggested based on what I said before. And that comes from the very famous Peking Man fossils near Beijing in northern China. So those are kind of the oldest of those tools that we have. And again, you do have more other tools. Again, unfortunately, the majority of them are organic. Scrapers are kind of one of the few stone tools that you have related to leatherworking. The majority of the rest of the tools you have are all organic. So, for example, they also discovered a lot of tools in somewhere called Contrebandier's Cave in Morocco, which date between around 90,000 and 120,000 years ago. And they are thought to be specialized tools for leatherworking. And again, there's been use wear studies on them, which suggests that this is the case. And they're quite specialized instruments. They're sort of almost a form of scraper and softener specifically meant for leatherworking. And again, 90,000 to 120,000 years ago, right? So the fact that they create these very specialized tools for this very particular purpose suggests that they have been doing this already for a long time. This is not something that just started then. It was happening already before them. So that's also quite interesting. And another interesting find that they discovered is these puncture boards. So, for example, there was an artifact which was found in Spain near Barcelona, dated to around 40,000 years ago. It's about 4 inches long. It's a flat piece of animal bone, most likely a wild horse or an auroch, which is the wild ancestor of the domestic cattle. And it has about 28 puncture marks spaced out in a very regular line. And usually it was thought that these marks were kind of decorative patterns, maybe an early form of notation or like to mark phases of the moon or something like that. But one of the theories, which I really like, is that actually maybe they were a sort of punching board for making holes in thick hides with an awl. Because when you're punching the awl through, it does help if you can puncture it into something, but you don't want to blunt your awl. So you don't want to puncture it directly into a hard surface. What you want is to have a hard surface with lots of holes in it so that you can kind of puncture the awl through the hide, and then the awl will sort of go into the hole and won't be blunted by hitting this hard material on the other side, which is, I think, a really fascinating concept. So that's also really interesting, because that suggests that there might be other forms of tools that we don't even think to look for that are also associated with clothing production in sort of early human society, like the Paleolithic and things. So, yeah. And again, like I say, it's, you know, it's just a theory with that board, right? Unfortunately, we can't, I don't think there's been any microanalysis conducted on it, at least not what I could find in my research. So what have we learned? We have learned that really, even though we do have particular examples, particular archaeological objects, particular things that have survived, have been able to survive in the ground due to the environment that is surrounding them, have been able to be discovered by archaeologists either during excavation or 60 years after the excavation, and can be linked in some way, however directly or indirectly, with clothing production. But we definitely don't have the whole picture. This is really only a fragment, if you will, of the entire picture. And there is so much more that remains to be discovered, hopefully, but maybe that will never be discovered just because of the lack of preservation opportunities. And so that's why we really have to go as much as possible with the information that we do have and try and interpret it as much as possible and get as much out of it using things like new scientific techniques, using things like experimental archaeology, like ethnographic studies, like, yeah, all kinds of interdisciplinary methods. So I think it's quite fascinating. And things like clothing are important because, as I mentioned before, they're not just a sort of practical, biologically required thing. We're the only animals that make our own clothes, right? No other animal has developed to the stage where it creates clothes. There's been quite a few animals that have their own tools, you know, but no animal really makes its own clothes. There are certain animals which do sort of almost camouflage themselves, which one could argue is a form of clothing production. And there are, of course, lots of birds and insects which create kind of buildings or nests and things like that. So there's definitely creativity, but in terms of clothes, in terms of decoration, that's something that seems to be purely human. And so I think that looking at clothes is quite an important part of looking at the development of human society and the evolution of humans as we know them today as well. So I hope that you enjoyed this tea break, this little dive into the archaeology of clothing. Coming up for the next few episodes, we have a discussion with Ronja Lau about textiles archaeology. So we'll be going a little bit more detail into what you can discover when you have nicely preserved textiles. The next few episodes, I'll also be talking with Jessica von Thumm about the archaeology of knitting. So another form of kind of cloth and fabric production. And yeah, as I mentioned in the last segment, please do get in touch and let me know what you want to hear about, what you think of the format, how you would, you know, like to see this podcast progressing, what you enjoy about it, what, you know, want to see more of, what you want to see potentially different or change, what you might suggest. Anyway, I'm open to anything. Please do get in touch. Don't forget to check out the APN and hopefully maybe support the network through becoming a member. You can also find all sorts of other amazing shows on the APN which deal with various different kinds of archaeology. And if you'd like to learn more about the topic of today's episode, all of the links to things that I mentioned today, as well as my contact information, can be found in the show notes. I hope that you enjoyed our journey today. If you did, make sure to like, follow, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and I'll see you next month for another episode of Tea Break Time Travel.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.